All right, good evening, everyone. Let's begin. So Parshas Bo, of course, is unique for a number of different reasons. Of course, it represents the ending of the section of the Makos. We read about the last three of the ten Makos, but perhaps what really takes center stage in Parshas Bo is that it is the actual Parsha of Yitzias Mitzrayim. It is the actual Parsha where ultimately 210 years of incredibly oppressive slavery comes to literally a grinding halt, which is strange. You would think that a dynamic that goes on for 210 years would be a little bit more gradual in the way that it comes to an end, but it doesn't. Vayibachatzos alayla, Paro gets Moshe Rabbeinu, essentially kicks Klal Yisrael out in the middle of the night, and a new chapter of Jewish existence begins. What I want to draw your attention to is something very interesting, a fascinating dynamic. There should be sheets. I guess the sheets are on the seats. Okay. An interesting dynamic that actually begins 3 weeks ago. A dynamic that actually began in Parshas Shmos with the first conversation between God and Moshe Rabbeinu and really continues all the way until this week's Parsha. Let's take a look at number one. Sakhadish Baruch Hu, this is already when God first meets Moshe Rabbeinu. Dan, there are seats right over here, up here. Don't be bashful, everyone. Please come in. Okay. So when God first meets Moshe, you know, Dr. Friedman, maybe can you set up, we'll set up a couple of more chairs on the side here. Thank you. Thank you. So when HaKadosh Baruch Hu first meets Moshe Rabbeinu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu first meets Moshe Rabbeinu by the snap, by the burning bush. So remember, there are a couple of things that happen during this first interaction. So number one, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, quote-unquote, convinces Moshe Rabbeinu to assume the mantle of leadership. And he also gives Moshe the plan. He tells Moshe everything that's going to unfold from the time that Moshe Rabbeinu first comes to Egypt all the way until Paro tells the people to leave. So if you look, take a look at number one, Torah says, V'nasat yeschin ha'am hazeh be'inei Mitzrayim, v'hayo ki seleichun lo silchu reikam. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe Rabbeinu something amazing. There's going to come a time where the Jewish people are actually going to find favor in the eyes of the Egyptians. And this favor is going to manifest itself in such a way that when they leave, they won't leave empty-handed. V'sha'allah isha mishchenta u'migaras besa klei kesef u'chlei zahav u'smalos v'samtem al b'neichem v'al b'noseichem v'nitzaltem es Mitzrayim. And a woman, sha'allah. Now, sha'allah means what? Right. So the truth is, you know, if you notice the English translation over here, not that that's a raya, you can find a lot of different English translations, but there's almost a reflexive reaction to translate it as borrow. Borrow, and a woman will borrow from her neighbor, from the dweller in her house, silver, gold, garments, you'll put them on your children, you'll literally empty out Egypt. We find the same exact word in number two, which is already in this week's parsha, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe Rabbeinu the plan. Now again, they're in the 11th hour. We're right about to leave Egypt. Moshe, these are the last minute instructions you must convey to the Jewish people. Number two, Dvayom Hashem al Moshe od nega echad avi al par v'al Mitzrayim. So here God tells him, we're at the 10th plague. Makas Bechor is death of the firstborn. Pasuk Beis, Daber na ba'aznei ha'am v'yish'alu. Ish me'esre'ehu v'isha me'esru'sa. Again, God uses the same exact word. Tell the people v'sha'alu, which again, the translation of here follows, tell them to borrow. Number three, which is finally where Moshe Rabbeinu actually gives over the command, remember, Paro says, get out, and doesn't even give them a chance to collect their belongings. They have to leave. They have to leave with such incredible speed that the dough itself can't rise. And what do they do? Uvnei Yisrael osu kidvar Moshe vayish alu mimitzrayim klei kesef uchlei zahav usmalos. They ask or they borrow from the Egyptians silver, gold, clothing. Vashem nasan eschina am beinei mitzrayim vayash ilum vayinasu es mitzrayim. And sure enough, just as God said it would happen, the Jews ask, the Egyptians give them incredible amounts of wealth. Vayinasu es mitzrayim. They literally empty out Egypt. They divest Egypt of all of its wealth. And so the fundamental question I'd like to try to explore tonight is, why does the Torah keep using the word Vishal? Vishal. A word that can be understood in so many different ways, but a word that could be misunderstood how? As meaning borrowed. Because the fundamental problem we have is what? If the word is going to be translated as borrowed, then what? Right. Then ultimately, this... You know what? Maybe Farrell could take out a couple of more chairs. Maybe this word could be so easily misunderstood that it can't mean borrow, because ultimately, again, borrow has a connotation that you're giving it back. There, of course, is no in there. There's no intention of giving any of this back. So why employ such a word? Unless you think that we're just being textually hypersensitive. Take a look at number four. There's an amazing Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara says, "Pam achas ba'o b'nei Mitzrayim ladun emisol etnei Alexandros Mokdon." One time, a delegation from Egypt came before Alexander the Macedonian, also known as Alexander the Great. Just a little interesting historical footnote. Who gave him the title Alexander the Great? He did. He did. It's good to know. If you really ever want to be known by a particular title, just give it to yourself. That's the easiest way. So there was once a Egyptian delegation that comes before Alexander the Great, and they come with a major complaint. What's the complaint? Amrulo, Harehu Omer, Vahashem Nasan Eschein Ha'am Beinei Mitzrayim, Vahashilum, Tinlu Lanu Hakesef, Vizav Shnatalta Mimenu. So the Egyptian delegation comes with exactly this claim. You Jews told us what? Shalu, you borrowed our stuff. You asked us for our stuff, and as if you were borrowing it, well, guess what? We want it back. We want our wealth back. So Amar Gevia ben Pasisa lechachamim. So there was a certain individual, not a very well-known sage, but a man, one of the people in the rabbinic community by the name of Gevia ben Pasisa, said to the sages, "Tinuli reshus ve'elich va'adon imarim lefnei Alexandros." So the Gemara goes on to say, Gevia ben Pasisa says, "You know what? I'm willing to do it." He faces down. He faces the Egyptian delegation. The Egyptian delegation makes their claim. So Gevia ben Pasisa says, "No problem. If we're going to settle claims, I have a counterclaim. My counterclaim is 600,000 men working for." He puts in there 400 years, 210 years. Let's do the math and see who owes who what. Alexander the Great turns to the Egyptian delegation, says, "Knew, what do you have to say to that?" They respond, "Give us 3 days to think about it," and they run back to Egypt in the interim. The point of the Gemara is we see that the word can be, and in fact was historically, misunderstood to mean borrow. If that's the case, we have to understand why HaKadosh Baruch Hu would choose such a word. And remember, it wasn't said once, it wasn't said twice, it was used a total of 3 times. 2 times in a conversation between God and Moshe, and one time from God to Moshe, one time from Moshe to the Jewish people, and one time when the Jewish people actually carried out this mandate. Why use a word, shalu, that could be so easily misunderstood? Okay. Good, could be a general, teaching us a general concept about property. Maybe nothing, no real ownership. Liyah kesef, liyah zav. Good, excellent. The truth is that might actually dovetail into one of our, yes. Oh, so we'll discuss. Wait, Chai, you're asking that's the word for borrowing? No, but remember, that's not the question. The question is why are we using that word for borrowing? The question is, why would we use a word that can be translated as borrowing when no one's borrowing anything? Right? Remember? Oh, so we'll see. So let's talk about that. Okay. So first of all, before we answer that question, there's just a follow-up question. Take a look at number 5. So the Gemara tells us, because there clearly is a very strong emphasis on the Jewish people leaving with wealth. Meaning, one would have thought that the real important thing at hand over here is what? Getting out of Egypt. Right? Let's just get out. We've been here for 210 years. You know what? We Jews, we're very resourceful people. We'll find a way to make a business out of something. So let's just get into the desert. We'll figure out the financial affairs later on. But there is such an emphasis that when you go, you must leave wealthy. Why? So the Gemara number 5 says, Daber no bazne'am. So what the Gemara picks up on is the following. That when God tells Moshe to speak to the people, he tells them, Daberna, please speak to the people, almost please ask the people, beg the people to ask the Egyptians for the gold, the silver, and the clothing. So the Gemara says, why do you have to beg people to ask for wealth? So the Gemara says, "Eino elosh b'akasha." Amalei Hakadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe b'akasha mimcha. Leich li emar lehem liyisar b'akasha mihem. Shalom b'mitzrayim klei kesef klei zahav. So literally, Hakadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe, "Moshe, when you go to the people, you have to tell them, God needs you to do Him a favor. What's the favor you have to do for God? You have to ask the Egyptians for the silver, the gold. You have to go out with wealth, even if you don't want it. Even if you say, you know what, forget about the wealth, just get us out of here. It's a favor for God. You have to do it for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Why does it matter so much to God?" So the Gemara says, "Shelo yomar osa tzadik ve'avadum ve'inu osam kiyem bahem ve'achrichen yetzir b'chushkad alo kiyem bahem." So the Gemara says so beautifully, because remember, this represents a closure to one circuit. That when God told Avram Avinu during the Bris Bein Abisarim about the dark chapter of Egyptian servitude, He told Avram, "Your children will be enslaved, they'll be afflicted." But what else did He tell Avram? The Acharei Ken Yetzu B'Rechush Gadol. They will go out with an incredible, vast amount of wealth. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kiviyachol says, "I don't want Avram to come to me with a complaint that here God upheld His promise of afflicting them, but He didn't uphold His promise of giving them wealth." So therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, essentially, "Don't make me a liar. I told Avram they'd go out with wealth. They have to act. Even if they don't want it, even if they're not interested in it, tell them they have to do it for me." So that explains the silver and the gold. But what's interesting to note is, once again, the Torah places a fascinating emphasis on clothing, on smalot, clothing. Which, and what's even more intriguing about it is what? Is we know that the Gemara tells us that one of the ways in which the Jewish people remained distinguished from the Egyptians during their time in Egypt was clothing. Clothing. So here we understand gold, we understand it represents wealth. Why the emphasis on clothing? And just to bolster that question once more, take a look at number 6. Rashi HaKadosh says something amazing. Usmalot and clothing, af hein hayu chashubos lahem, astounding. What was the most important possession the Jewish people got from Egypt? The clothing. The clothing was more important than the silver. The clothing was more important than the gold. Because Rashi understands that that's which it goes essentially in order of least to greatest importance. So you begin with kasef, zahav, smalot. Gold, silver, clothing. Clothing was most important to them. So again, how... Silver, gold, clothing. So how are we to understand the incredible importance of the clothing? So we have two questions we're going to focus on tonight. Number one, why does the Torah use the word sha'alu, which can be translated as borrowed, if it could be so misleading? There's no borrowing going on over here. Question number one. Question number two is, how are we to understand the emphasis or the importance of clothing? Gold, silver, we understand, fulfillment of Abrahamic promise, but why the emphasis on clothing? So there are a couple of different approaches to this. If we take a look at number seven, the Ibn Ezra takes a very simple approach. He says, now again, these answers are going to be more focused on understanding the usage of the word v'sha'alu, of borrowing. So the Ibn Ezra writes, V'yesh mis'onanim, v'omrim ki avosinu ganavim hayu. So the Ibn Ezra writes, some want to say that our forefathers were thieves. Our ancestors were thieves. Why? Because they went over to the Egyptians and said, excuse me, can I borrow your gold and silver? Right? But one second. They had no intention of borrowing. They were taking, but yet they said they were borrowing. So look what the Ibn Ezra writes. V'eila halo yiru ki mitzvah el yona haisa. So the Ibn Ezra says, who cares? That is what God told us to do. Ve'ein tam lishol lama. The Ibn Ezra takes a very authoritarian approach to this. He says, there's no room to ask why. Ki Hashem bara hakol. Hashem bara hakol. And this goes almost a little bit with what Regina was saying before. God created everything. Ve'hu nasan osher l'misha yirtzeh. V'yikachenu miyado v'yitnenu la'acher. God owns everything anyway. And therefore, maybe this is where the president got it from, right? Redistribution of wealth, right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu has the right to give to whoever He wants. See, He wants to take it from the Egyptians and give it over to the Jews. That's His prerogative. V'ein zera ki akol shalo. So the Ibn Ezra says something amazing. The Ibn Ezra says that perhaps, well, the Ibn Ezra doesn't finish the thought, but perhaps what he means is the following. It's not called a lie. Why is it not called a lie? Because it's what God commanded us to do. And perhaps to take it a step further, maybe what the Ibn Ezra is highlighting, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu purposely tells us to use a phrase that we are somewhat uncomfortable with. Why? Why does he tell us to do that? Because what does this represent in the view of the Ibn Ezra? An act of obedience. An act of obedience. Do it because I told you to do it. This is an interesting part of our Judaism, which sometimes makes us a little bit uncomfortable, because we like to be in a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We like to be in a loving relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we like to understand why God tells us to do the things He tells us to do. But in the man-God relationship, at the most foundational level, is obedience. That we do what we do simply because God tells us to do it. That's the motivation. All of the beautiful love and other stuff comes in afterwards. But at its core, at its foundation, it's obedience. So according to Ibn Ezra, the first lesson in the relationship between God and the Jewish people, because the truth is, remember, up until now, the Jewish people had not been asked to do anything. I mean, they were asked to do Karban Pesach, but that was really just eating a meal in the house. This was the first real public thing they were asked to do, to ask for the gold and the silver and the clothing of the Egyptians. They did a little bit with the lamb as well, but this is much more dramatic. This is much more dramatic, and they're asked to do it in a way that probably did not sit very well with them. But you know what? That's what having a relationship with God means, says the Ibn Ezra. It means obedience. And it's easy to be obedient when it's comfortable, and it's easy to be obedient when it makes sense, and it's easy to be obedient when it fits in with my sensitivities. But true obedience to HaKadosh Baruch Hu means a willingness to do what God wants of me, what God asks of me, even if it's a little bit uncomfortable for me. Okay, that's the Ibn Ezra. Take a look at number 8. The Ibn Ezra also brings down another approach. We'll call this more of a utilitarian approach. So the Ibn Ezra writes, now again, this doesn't address the clothing, but it helps address the shawl. So in number 8, a second approach to the Ibn Ezra, the Chachma Sashem Niskava Midatenu. So it almost sounds like he's about to say the same, bless you, same thing again. Namely, that the wisdom of God is beyond us. The wisdom of God is beyond us. He says, V'asher nirali, Shehaya zeh davar, ba'avur shnei dvarim. So says the Ibn Ezra, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu asked us to ask the Egyptians for their gold and silver in what would appear to be a misleading fashion for two reasons. Aleph, he says, ha'echad, shiyitnu lehem klei kesef izav. V'ilu yadu shelo yashuvu, lo hayu nesunim. Very simply, because if the Jews would have just simply asked for the gold and silver, and in a final act of giving, give us your possessions to keep, what would have been the Egyptian response? No. Unless you think, that's ridiculous. They're dying. Of course they're going to give up their gold and silver. Remember what HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us. With all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your money. Asks the Gemara, if I have to love God with all of my heart and all of my soul, which means my life, then why does it have to tell me to love God with my money? To which the Gemara gives a very profound answer. Because Yesh b'nei Adam shechavivin mamonam yoser migufan. Because there are some people that love their money more than they love life itself. So says the Ibn Ezra, the Egyptians were willing to go down with the ship. So if they thought that they were actually giving over their money to the Jews and that to the Bnei Israel, and that was it, they wouldn't have given it. So says the Ibn Ezra, there's utilitarian purpose over here. The Jews deserve that money. That's theirs. That's part of the Abrahamic promise. So how do you get it out of the Egyptians? So you know what? Yeah, you have to maybe tell a little bit of a half-truth in order to accomplish a greater good. That's number one. Then he gives another approach. He says, Asheni sheyitva paro v'chelo. The second approach is quite fascinating. He says it had to be done in this somewhat backhanded fashion. Why? Because this was the motivation for Paro and the Egyptians to chase the Jews once they left Egypt. The Ibn Ezra says something amazing. Have you ever wondered to yourself, why did Paro chase the Jews out? They released them already. They were gone already. What was the catalyst to chase them down when they were 3 days already out of Egypt? Says the Ibn Ezra, you know what it was? Money. Because when they realized that they had taken all the wealth of Egypt, and hey, they're not coming back. They're not coming back. That actually is a good reason to run after them. Right? Because the entire Egyptian economy could be teetering on the verge of collapse if we don't get back the wealth. So says the Ibn Ezra, HaKadosh Baruch Hu needs Paro and needs the Egyptians to chase the Jews to the Yam Suf. Well, how are you going to get them to do that? Very simply, their money. So according to the second approach, is a more utilitarian approach, that God purposely uses an open-ended and actually very clearly and easily misunderstood word, either A, because that was the only way the Jews were going to get the wealth, or B, because that was the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu set up the system that the Egyptians would pursue the Jews into the desert, and ultimately the showdown by Yam Suf would take place. We then come to a third answer, which we'll call a definitional approach, which negates the entire question. So Rabbeinu B'chayi says in number 9, V'sha'ala isha mishkenta. So look what he says. Chas v'shalom sheyatir HaKadosh Baruch Hu lignov das abrios sheyishalu mehem klei kesef u'chleizav lo yashivu lahem. So it's so interesting just to see how the Mefarshim deal with this differently. So Rabbeinu B'chayi says, chas v'shalom, that God would tell us to lie. HaKadosh Baruch Hu would never tell us to lie. HaKadosh Baruch Hu would never make... Sounds strange. God would never make such a chilul Hashem. Right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu would never tell us to lie to the Egyptians and to pretend like we're trying to get it, but we're borrowing it. No! Says Rabbeinu B'chayi, something simpler. Aval lashon v'sha'alah hu shetitin laba matana. Says Rabbeinu B'chayi, why are you guys making yourself all crazy? V'sha'alah means what? To ask. To ask. It doesn't mean to borrow. It just simply means to ask. Now ask why. Now why would they give it? It would have to be a gift. The Jews are asking for a gift, which means that the Egyptians had the prerogative to agree or to disagree. But says Rabbeinu B'chayi, you're all making yourself crazy because you're misinterpreting the word. The word v'sha'alah does not mean borrow. The word v'sha'alah means ask. And in fact, if you look at the Rashbam and the Kli Yakar, they both say the same ideas. V'sha'alah number 10, b'matana gemura v'chaluta, right? Just they're asking for a gift. Number 11, yesh mefarshim she'ela zu, lashon halva. So says the Kli Yakar, some want to say that she'ela means to borrow, means alone. And right, the Kli Yakar, how would God ever tell us to do something backhanded that would almost appear like Kenevas Das, like lying to someone? Elo humi lashon shal. So again, ve'etne lecha kach she'ilazu hu sheyitnu lematanos. So says the Kli Yakar, says Rashi, says Rabbeinu B'chayi, stop making yourself crazy. The word v'shala means to ask. Ask why? Ask for a simple gift. And if you take a look at Rav Hirsch in number 12, Rav Hirsch is the starkest. Rav Hirsch says, Shala, look what he writes over here. I apologize for the print quality. He says, this word has an unfortunate history. Very dramatic. Look what he says. It occurs at least a few hundred times in Tanakh, and there, meaning in the few hundred times in Tanakh, it always has the meaning to demand, to request, to obtain by entreaty. Never to borrow. In the hundreds of times that it's in Tanakh, the shal never means to borrow. But once again, it doesn't make sense. That's how we interpret it. So Hirsch says, in one single instance alone, it is used for borrowing. V'chi yishal ish me'im re'ehu. And this one single instance, just because it happens to describe a legal relationship, and in consequence the word shal has become current in all the laws referring to a borrower, and is of everyday use, has been the cause of people singing the expression shalah here, at once the idea of us to borrow. But they overlook completely the form of speech which is inevitably used. Always, everywhere, shal means to demand, to request, i.e. when that which is demanded to be asked for is to completely leave. Okay, so if Hirsch says, again, really in line with Rabbeinu B'chayi, with the Rashbam, with the Kli Yakar, that it's not a question. It's not a question. The Sha'al just means to ask. And by the way, according to this approach, the greatness of this event is, you could imagine, how the same people that enslaved you for 210 years, who probably acted towards you in such a terrible, terrible, despicable, and demeaning manner, now you're going to ask them for a gift. A gift for what reason? Just because I'm asking, and they're going to say... sure, right? That's it. Well, maybe they could also say, they could say no. The truth is, we don't know. I'm sure there were those who said no as well. But the point, says the Rabbeinu B'chayi, Rashbam, Kli Yakar, Eben Rav Hirsch, you're misinterpreting the word. So these three approaches represent, and again, there obviously are other approaches as well, but these are the main approaches to understanding the Sha'al problem. So again, number one, the Ibn Ezra, which essentially says, stop asking questions, it's what God told us to do, and that's why we have to do it. And maybe that, in fact, was the lesson. asking us to do something which we are a little bit uncomfortable with as a way of allowing us to demonstrate our newfound obedience to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Second approach, utilitarian approach, also the Ibn Ezra, that no, he had to ask that way because otherwise they would have never given us the money. And we had to get the money because that was part of the fulfillment of the Abrahamic promise. Number two, that's what? That was the only way to get the Egyptians to do what? To chase us into the desert and ultimately set the stage for the showdown by Yam Suf. And last approach, definitional approach of Ibn Mechayr, Rashbam, Kliyaka, Rav Hirsch. You guys are all getting it wrong. Vishal never means to borrow. And Rav Hirsch is the most compelling. One time. One time out of hundreds that this word is used in Tanakh doesn't mean to borrow. Everywhere else it means to ask. And therefore, says Rav Hirsch, there's no reason to assume that this usage should resemble the one time. The statistical probability is that it resembles the hundreds of other times, and therefore the word simply means to ask. Which, all of these approaches are fascinating, of course. They give us an insight into Shaul, but of course they don't totally help us, or they don't really at all help us, with the clothing issue. Which then leads us to our fourth approach, which will hopefully allow us, number one, to achieve a real understanding of why the word Shaul is used, and also shed a little bit of light on the clothing dynamic as well. So the Chizkuni number 13 says something truly amazing. The Chizkuni writes, Lo silchu reikam. See, the Chizkuni is bothered by what we're bothered by, which is, why the emphasis on the wealth? Why the emphasis on the wealth? You know, it's an interesting thing that we straddle this very fine line. That on one hand, Judaism is not an ascetic religion, right? We don't believe that the way you have to come through to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is through privation, it's through denying yourself things. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, He created it for us to enjoy. So we don't despise materialism, we don't despise wealth. We look at wealth as an exceptional bracha. It's not what we put on a pedestal as the ultimate aspiration in life, but nevertheless, here there's such a focus on it. Here, so okay, we had the Gemara that explained that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to make sure the Abrahamic promise is fulfilled, but the Mefarshim are really bothered by this. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why are you speaking so much about the wealth every time you speak about the Exodus? So the Chizkuni says something amazing, number 13. He says, Lo silchu reikam, ki heim ya'aniku lachem migimul minim. Because the Egyptians, now we'll translate this word ya'aniku in just a little bit, they will ya'aniku you, they will give you these from these three things, Kesef, Zahav, Usmalos. They'll give you gold, or they'll give you silver, gold, and clothing. Lekayim, Yetzu Berchush Gadol. In order to fulfill the Abrahamic promise that the Jewish people will leave with great wealth, Dugmas, Ha'anokas, Eved, Tzon, Goren, V'yekev. Because this resembles the process of when we emancipate a Jewish servant, because when we emancipate the Jewish servant, we also give him from three different things, namely, from your sheep, from your goren, from your threshing floor, your yekev, your wine press. So what is this talking? Now take a look at number 14. So the Torah says the following. Ki mocher lecha achicha he'ivri o ha'ivriya. So if a fellow Jew, a man or a woman, is sold to you as a servant, v'avdecha she'shanim, a Jewish servant serves 6 years, u'bashana ha'shviyis teshalchenu chavshe mi'imach. And in year number 7, you must go ahead and send them free from you. Now remember, Jewish, you know, the word servitude, the words, I think it's also difficult for us because certainly from an American standpoint, when we think about, when we use the word eved, which we translate as servant or slave, we think about black slavery in this country, and we think about just the oppressive conditions of that. So Jewish servitude was, of course, nothing like that. In fact, the Gemara goes so far to say that kala kona eved, kana adol na'atzmo. If you acquired a Jewish servant, you think you acquired a servant, you actually acquired a master. Why? Because the Gemara goes through how careful you must be to go ahead and take care of the needs of the eved. To the point the Gemara says, I have one pillow in my house, right? Who gets it? Right, my Evan, my servant gets it. I can't give him any inferior food than whatever than I'm eating. Whatever is my standard of living has to be his standard of living. So the truth is, it's pretty much like having a live-in who you really have to take care of in the same manner that you're accustomed to living in. The Gemara says, so not only have I been taking care, he's been working for me for the last 6 years. I'm not paying him a wage, but his wage is in the form of room and board. He's totally taken care of. But Torah says, when he goes free, lo se shalchenu reikam. You can't send him away empty-handed. Rather, ha'anik ta'anik lo, migarncha, mitzoncha, migarncha mikvecha. So this word is very interesting. The translation over here that's used is, you shall surely provide for him. We'll discuss the actual etymology in the word in just a moment. But you'll provide for him from your sheep, from your flock, from garncha, from your threshing floor, from your wine. These are literal, but these represent the three different types of possessions that people would have: livestock, agriculture, wine. So the point is, whatever you have as wealth, right, you have to give your servant some of that as well. So anything that God has blessed with, you have to give your servant. Because remember that you were too once a servant in Egypt, and God redeemed you. Therefore, I, God, am commanding you to do this. So what's the intriguing part of this halacha? Right? So the truth is, I'll tell you, it doesn't sound fair. It doesn't sound fair. Really, what the Eved is getting is a bonus. He's getting, right, he's getting, I guess what we call today, a golden parachute. Right, meaning, remember, a person gets into avdus for all different kinds of reasons. Right, a person could just be totally destitute, but a person may have also committed a crime. They may have committed an act of theft that they can't pay off. And so they're sold into servitude by the Beis Din. So this person may be a good guy, may not be a good guy, whatever the case may be. But at the end of the day, it's not like he's been working for free all these years. He was working off a debt. He was working to fulfill some other kind of responsibility. I gave him room and board. And now when he's finished, I have to give him more. I have to give him more. So I've been taking care of him for the last 6 years. And now I have to give him the golden parachute for the next stage in life. I'm saying it doesn't seem very equitable. So the Sefer HaChinuch gives an interesting approach. In number 15, the Sefer HaChinuch writes, he says, Mishra Shem Mitzvah, the essence of the mitzvah is the following. L'man nikne b'nafshenu midos mu'ulos ikaros v'chamudos. So the Sefer HaChinuch says, you're right. Ha'anoka, giving the servant this extra golden parachute, this extra, you know, seed money for the rest of his life, is not about him. Who is it about? It's about me. Doing this makes me the master a better person. Why? Because what it does is it sensitizes my soul. And by sensitizing my soul, I become a better person.
Milvad mashis ninu imola seis lo bischaro, the davar muskal hu in tzorich laharichbo.
So the Sefer HaChinuch says something amazing. He says it's a din in hakaras hatov. Hakaras hatov, right, of gratitude. This person just spent the last 6 years of his life working for me. The truth is, hopefully, he was a good worker. I have to express my appreciation for him. I have to express my appreciation. What are you talking about? I just did that for the last 6 years. I gave the guy my pillow. I had one pillow for the last 6 years. He had my pillow every single night. That's hakaras hatov. I took care of him. No. You have to go above and beyond. You have to show even more hakaras hatov, recognizing the sacrifice. Because remember, the Eved ultimately often did what? The things that I don't want to do. Right? He maybe did the menial work. He did the farm. The things that I want to do, he did. So I have to express my hakaras hatov that he was moser nefesh for me. He gave. He sacrificed me for the last 6 years. Even though I paid him, the score is settled. I have to give him a little bit extra. Why? Because if I do this, it makes me a better person. Does he deserve it? Did he earn it? No, he got what he earned. He got what he deserved. But this makes me a better person. And by refining myself, I put myself on the trajectory of successful living. Okay. Leaving that, so the Sefer HaChinuch is fascinating, but the truth is, perhaps there's a simpler approach. Let's analyze the word ha'anaka. Ha'anaka means what? So what's interesting is the following. In the word ha'anaka, right, we have the word anak, right? Anak means what? A giant, right? But of course, we also have the word, right, meneket. Meneket, laha'anik, means what? To nurse. When a mother nurses her child, ultimately, what is she doing? She's delivering basic core sustenance to the child to allow the child to mature,
to allow the child to grow. That's why, again, if you get enough ha'anaka, if you get enough nursing, then you become an anak, then you become a giant. So perhaps you could suggest the following. And what's happening over here? When a person becomes an eved, and here we're talking about a Jewish servant who is treated just like a Jewish servant is the same way, that when a person becomes an eved, though, the danger of becoming a servant is that a person could lose their humanity. That a person begins to think of themselves as an object. And the truth is, remember, avodim, servants, in many areas of halacha, this is more applies to non-Jewish than Jewish servants, are treated like real property. In certain respects, they share certain common characteristics with land, with karka. So over 6 years of servitude, a person could fundamentally lose their sense of self, a person could forget about their humanity, and a person could begin to feel like an object. You know, there's an interesting Gemara. The Gemara says that avadim, slaves, were known to be exceptionally immoral. Immorality was known to exist among avadim. Why is that? Does that mean because servants or slaves were bad people? No, because when you become a servant long enough, you lose your human kite, right? You don't feel like a person as much anymore. When you don't feel like a person, you're not bound by those same moral norms or mores that govern the rest of humanity. You let your moral guard down because you no longer feel like you have to live up to the same standard as everyone else. So amazingly enough, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to the master, when your servant goes free, your obligation is what? Ha'anik ta'aniklo. Torah could have just said give him money. Torah could have just said give him sheep. It purposely uses the lashon ha'anik ta'anik, which means what? What are you supposed to do? Nurse him. The job of the master is to rehabilitate the servant. The job of the master is to help the servant reclaim his sense of self, is to once again make him feel like he is a human being. Hanek taneklo. Nurse him. Nurture him. Give him something so that he could feel like an anak. That he could feel ultimately like a giant. That he could once again feel like the person he was before he entered into this servitude. So how do we do this on the most basic level? We give him possessions. Because when you have possessions, when you have things, right? When you possess things, then what? Right? You're a person. You have a sense of autonomy. I've quoted this in the past. That's out of Soloveitchik. Zecher Tzadik Livracha points out that how do we begin the Pesach Seder? Right? We begin with Halach Ma'anya. Right? So what do we say in Halach Ma'anya? Kol dichvin yesei v'yechol, kol ditzrich yesei v'yifsach. We make a proclamation. Whoever wants, such a magnanimous proclamation. Whoever wants to come join me for the Seder, open house. Come one, come all. What's the only problem? Right, first of all, doors closed, right? I'm saying it to the people who are already at my table. So what's the pshat? So the Rav explains so beautifully, I think I quoted this in the past, that we're making a declaration of freedom. What we're saying is, if I wanted to invite more people, I could do that. You know why? Because I have possessions. And having possessions is the ultimate manifestation of freedom. A slave doesn't own anything. Because a slave doesn't... How do you acquire something in this world? Right? An object comes, you put it in your hand, it's yours, because your yad is yours. A slave's yad is not his. His yad is his master. So therefore the Torah says, ha'anik tanik, nurture him, nurse him, rehabilitate him, give him back his sense of self. And on the most basic level, how do you do that? Give him possessions. Give him things. Give him a sense of ownership, so that he will once again begin to feel like a mensch. So here's something amazing. Now we begin to understand why God is so insistent on the Jewish acquisition of wealth. Because here's what's amazing. You know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could feed the Jewish people, no problem, which he does. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could perform all of the incredible miracles that we see in the parasha. But there's one thing that only the Egyptians could give to the Jewish people. And what's that? Right? A recognition of their humanity. You see, for the last 210 years, the Egyptians dehumanized the Jewish people. Right? For the last 210 years, in the eyes of the Egyptians,
the Jew was simply a beast of burden. There was an ox, there was a Jew, it's no different. V'harayo, they took our babies and they threw our babies into the Nile. And the Medrash points out that if there was a shortage of bricks, they would put the babies, they would take infants and put them into the mortar and fashion bricks out of them. How do you do that? And we see that, by the way, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam V'Zichram. How do you do things like that? The only way you could do something like that is how? Is if you don't believe that the person you're persecuting is a person. If you dehumanize them, which is what our enemies have done throughout Egypt, that's how atrocities that are unspeakable. How do you do that? Meaning there's basic human compassion that every person has. But if you don't believe that the person or the entity you're persecuting is a person, then you take out all the stops. So for the last 210 years, the Jewish people have been fundamentally dehumanized by the Mitzrim. So what do we need from the Mitzrim? God could give us so much. But what do we need from the Mitzrim now? We need them to acknowledge what? That we are people. We need them to acknowledge, we need them to rehabilitate our sense of self. God can't do that for us. Only the oppressor can do that for the oppressed. Amazingly enough, if you look at number 14, so Nechama Leibowitz points out over here something beautiful. She says, for an Israelite, the word Egyptian had the bitterest associations. It would not have been remarkable had the Jew hated the Egyptian as the enslaver of his ancestors and would have reserved the right not to accord him the generous treatment enjoined by the Torah with regard to the stranger. That's referring to the fact that later on the Torah tells us that we're not permitted to taunt or to afflict the Egyptian because we were strangers in his land. But the Torah records that the Egyptians and Jews parted friends. The former liberally furnishing them with gifts, as the latter themselves had been bidden, in the case of sending away their own Hebrew servants. Consequently, thou shalt not abhor the Egyptian, for thou wert a stranger in his land. But since the Egyptians could not be expected to offer gifts of their own initiative, Israel was bidden to spur them to do it and to say to them, let us part friends, and we'll take with us a parting gift. So what does that mean? Here's something amazing. The Jewish people need something from the Egyptians. What do they need? What do they need? They need a recognition of humanity. I need you to tell me, you who treated me like a beast of burden, you who my children weren't even human beings in your eyes, I need you to acknowledge the fact that I am a human being. I need you, only you, my master, could restore my sense of self. Only you, my master, could take what you took from me over the last 210 years. But amazingly enough, and that's what Nechama Leibowitz is writing over here, you can't really expect the Egyptians to be proactive in this process. In the same way, by the way, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not expect the master of the Jewish servant to be proactive in giving away his possessions. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to command the Jewish master to do it as well. So look what's unfolding over here. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells the Jewish people, go to the Egyptians and what? V'yish'alu. V'yish'alu means what? According to our last approach. Ask. Ask. Because you know what? If you go over to the Egyptians, right? If you bang on the door and you say, give me your gold, what will they do? They're going to give it to you. Chances are they're going to give it to you. Why? Because they're scared. Because remember, what's happening that night in Egypt? Everybody's dying. Everybody's dying. Right? Rashi points out that the Egyptian women were exceptionally promiscuous. So they had firstborns from multiple men. So it's not just people think that there was one, you know, one person, you know, if you watch the Ten Commandments, there's only one person dying in each house. Right? It's not just Rashi points out. There are multiple people dying, right, in each and every home. So everybody's dying all around them. So if they would have walked in and commanded, give us the gold, give us the silver, they would have given it to them. But that's not what the Jewish people want. Because the Shbaruch Hu says, ask them nicely. Ask them nicely. Might you have any gold and silver that I can have? Ask. Ask. Maybe they'll say yes. Maybe they'll say no. But if they say yes, they're not going to say yes out of fear. If they say yes, they're going to say yes because they recognize that there's a human being standing opposite them in the threshold. They're going to recognize you not as a beast of burden, but they're going to recognize you as a person. And that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu Dafka uses that word, Vayishalu, don't demand it. Because what you need, what is, see, now we understand, what God, it's not about the wealth. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could furnish us with wealth in a multiplicity of ways. It's about the fact that if the Egyptians give us possessions willingly, They are rehumanizing us. By giving us possessions, they're giving us autonomy. You wouldn't give gold to your cow. You wouldn't give gold to your mule. But if you give it to a person, it means you recognize the humanity of that individual. So amazingly enough, what's the Egyptian response? Take a look at number 16. So the Kliyoka writes, Umash ne'emar vayash ilum. So amazingly enough, you don't have to look at it inside, but the Torah, this was in source number 3, the Torah says that God, what was the Egyptian response? The Jews asked for gold, for silver, gold clothing, vayash ilum. Vayash ilum is the reciprocal of vayishalu. They asked, I don't know how you translate this right way in English, but they asked, and the Egyptians did what? Responded to the request. Look what the Kliyoker says. Umash nemar vayashilum hayu shamitzrim hischilu litvoa mehem sheikablu mehen matanos. The Egyptians were trying to give them more and more. But you see, everybody thinks that that was motivated out of fear. Writes the Kliyoker, kol kach matzu chein be'enehem. It wasn't out of fear. It was out of what? A recognition of humanity. Because whatever this means, the Jewish people found favor in the eyes of the Egyptians. On the most basic level, they once again were looking at them as people. And maybe, just maybe, there was even a little bit of charata. Maybe there was a little bit of remorse for how they treated these people over the last 210 years. So the people asked nicely, and the Egyptians responded nicely. And so amazingly enough, in these final moments in Egypt, the Jewish people were able to get the one thing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu could not give them. The one thing that only the Egyptians could give them. The ha'anaka, the nourishment of being rehumanized. The nourishment of once again knowing that your tormentor looks at you not as a beast of burden, but ultimately as a person. Because once you get that, you could emerge with a true sense of self. And now we understand the clothing. Because remember, as you pointed out, the number 17 is just a repeat from the pasuk. But that's the amazing part. Despite the fact that the servitude ended, until they were rehumanized, until the Egyptians dealt with them as people, as peers, they still felt like servants. It's not a question of just the servitude. They literally had to have this interaction with the Egyptians to be rehumanized. So now again, now we begin to understand the clothing. So if you remember again, we spoke about the clothing. Number one, why the emphasis on the clothing? 18 is Rashi that I pointed out before, where Rashi says that out of all the things they took from Egypt, what was the most important thing to them? The clothing. What's the pshat? So, you know, clothing is interesting. Clothing is interesting because clothing in reality serves a dual role. So clothing, number one, endows the wearer, if that's the right word, wearer? Yeah, endows the wearer, sounds strange, endows the wearer with a positive self-image. Right? When you dress a certain way, it makes you feel a certain way about yourself. So amazingly enough, if you take a look at number 20, so for example, the Sefer HaChinuch writes, by the Big Day Kahuna, Shenitztavu HaKohanim Lilbosh Begadim Miyuchadim L'Gdula V'Chavod V'Az Yavdu B'Mikdash. Do you ever wonder to yourself, the Kohanim have to go ahead and wear all these special clothing? And the truth is, it's the kind of clothing that you really would never wear on the outside. It's not like the pshat, like I have a suit for during the week and a suit for Shabbos, but they're suits, right? The Kohanic clothing is not something that... Nobody's making knockoff Kohanic clothing, you know, and selling it on a street corner because there's such a demand for it. Nobody's wearing this. So what's the pshat? Like, why do the Kohanim have to wear something that, you know, it's just not part of any other kind of, we'll call it, fashion norm? So Sefer HaChinuch says something amazing, 20 days. He says, Mishroshi HaMitzvah, because at the essence of this is HaYisod HaKavu Alanu Ki HaAdam Nifal Lefi Pu'ulosav. So this is Sefer HaChinuch's mantra, that a person is influenced by their actions. How, you know, there's a fundamental dispute within Judaism in terms of how does the pathway to a good life begin? Does it begin with a good heart that translates into good actions? Or do good actions create a good heart? So Sefer HaChinuch goes with the second one.
right? That you can wait a lifetime for a good heart. There's people who wait a lifetime to be inspired. Everybody wants to be inspired. Right? You want to be inspired? Get off the couch if you want to be inspired. Right? Do something. You'll be inspired. You want inspiration? Do something inspiring. And then you will feel inspired internally as well. So the Sefer HaChinuch writes something amazing. He says, "Vashliach hamechaper tzarich lahatfis kol machshavto v'kavanoso el avoda." So the Sefer HaChinuch says, you want to know why the Kohen has to have special clothing? Because he must always realize that what he is doing is special and unique. And how do you do that? If that clothing resembled something else that he has in his closet, so ultimately the uniqueness will wear off. But because the big tikkun was so radically different than anything else that people were wearing, every time the Kohen looked at any part of his body which was covered with the big tikkun, he was reminded how special his task, how special his mandate, how special his destiny was. This is the first aspect of clothing. And by the way, what's true for the Kohanim, this is the whole concept behind tznius. When I say tznius, please understand, I don't mean a simplistic view of tznius, of sleeve lengths, or those are important details, but that's not the essence of it. Right, the true essence of tznius for men and for women is the yisod that ultimately how you put yourself together ultimately influences how you feel about yourself, and how you feel about yourself fundamentally colors the way you live your life. That's the first aspect. But there's another interesting aspect of clothing, which is not just about how it makes you feel about yourself, but clothing also allows others to form their initial impression of you. Meaning, whether we like to admit it or not, when we see someone, we absolutely size up our initial judgments about the people by how they look. By how they look. And that's not a bad thing, it's just a human thing. It's just sometimes we know looks could be deceiving in so many different ways, but nevertheless, that's how we interact, because we're visual. So I see someone dressed a certain way or looking a certain way, I just, in my mind, I have certain assumptions about that individual. See, here's what's amazing. Lest you think it's just a Jewish idea, take a look at number 21. I actually quoted this a couple of years ago in a different context. So this is from... this was a study that was done out of California State University. You can see over here in 2002. So this, you can see this online in National Institute of Health. So look at this study. A field experiment explored whether a female shopper's appearance would influence the customer service she received. Listen to this. Specifically, a female confederate. A confederate literally means like an accomplice. It means the person who was in on the experiment. So a female confederate dressed in formal work clothes, skirt and blouse, or in formal gym clothes, tights and a t-shirt, entered a series of randomly selected women's clothing stores in a large mall and proceeded to quote-unquote shop. The amount of time that passed before an employee approached and acknowledged the confederate served as the dependent variable. So what's the experiment over here, right? How will the salespeople interact with someone who's dressed, we'll call it a little bit more, I don't know, I don't want to be careful, I don't want to, right? We'll call it... we're going to get to that in just a moment. Oh, good, we're going to get to that in just a moment. So look at this. So the amount of time, listen to how fascinating this is. The as hypothesized, she was acknowledged significantly sooner when formally attired than when informally dressed. Thus, clothing, like other aspects of appearance, influences how people are evaluated and treated by others. So by the way, this is not like out of an art scroll book. You know, this is not like some public Jewish... This is nothing to even do with religion. This study is all about how clothing, how you dress influences how other people perceive you. Okay, so this is not rocket science. We understand it. But we see clothing serves this dual purpose. Number one, that clothing ultimately shapes how you feel about yourself. And clothing also shapes how others feel about you. Now watch this. Watch this. Now we understand. Now we understand why clothing was so important for leaving Mitzrayim. So let's begin to put this together. So now we understand, according to this approach, when they're asking for gold and silver, right? They're not just simply asking for gold and silver. Vayish'alu. What are they actually doing? They're asking what? What are they asking? Do you recognize me as a person? I'm going to ask you for something. And the way you respond to that request will ultimately tell me how I rank in your eyes. Vayishalu. Vayishalu. I'm not demanding, I'm not threatening. I'm just simply asking you, will you give me something? Ultimately, vayashilum. They respond in kind, and amazingly enough, the humanity of the Jewish people is revitalized. Now, amazing enough, but why do they need the clothing? Because now, they also need to begin to look at themselves differently. That although, interestingly enough, they didn't wear the Egyptian clothing, all 210 years they were in Egypt, now what did they do in those final moments? They donned the clothing of their former masters. When you put on the clothing of the master, what did you become? You become the master. And so for a people who have just been given a new destiny, for a people who have been given a yet to be written future, the most important lesson that Kodesh Baruch Hu wanted to impress upon them is your life is yours to make of it what you please. You don't have a human master anymore. You don't have someone you report to. Yes, you're all under me, you're all under HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but you are now the masters of your destiny. The same clothing that they despised, the same clothing that represented oppression for 210 years, in their final moments in Egypt, they put it on to show we are no longer the servants. They take off the soiled clothing of servitude, they take off the clothing of Havadim, they don the clothing of masters, because they have now become the masters of their faith. And when they put on that clothing, something amazing happens. Because remember, clothing serves a twofold purpose. So now they look different in their eyes, and they look different to who else? To the Egyptians as well. So in these final moments of redemption, these final moments of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Egyptians do something for the Jews, and the Jews do something for themselves that HaKadosh Baruch Hu could not do for them. God could perform miracles. God could stop your servitude. God can't give you a sense of self. God can't give you a sense of identity. I have to make that for myself. So, and to bring this all together, what we have over here is the following. One more time, I know I'm being repetitive, but it's such a profound yisod. See, here what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us to do is God is not wealth-centric. God is not wealth-focused. But here, the wealth represented rehumanization of the people. Ha'anik ta'anik lo. Only the Egyptians could give us back the identity they robbed us of for the last 210 years. Vayishalu. So yes, we don't demand. We don't say give it to us. We don't say fork it over. We don't say magiali. But rather, we say, please. Please. Will you give it to me? Vayashilum. They give it to us. Amazing. Rehumanization, revitalization of a sense of self that only the oppressor who took it from us could give us back. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, but that's not it. It's not just enough for you to feel a sense of self. You now have to project a new image for yourself and for the world around you. And therefore the emphasis on clothing. Take the clothing of the Egyptians. Put it on. Put it on. Show yourself that you are not the same people. Show yourself that you are no longer servants. Show yourself that you are the masters of your own destiny. And show your oppressors that you are not leaving here as meek, weak slaves, but you are leaving here as masters of your future. The beautiful idea being that HaKadosh Baruch Hu understood that in order for us to have any shot at building a beautiful future, we would have to leave Egypt with an intact sense of self. If you don't feel good about yourself, if you don't feel that you're important, if you don't feel that your presence in this world actually makes a difference, you could have all the wonderful miracles, you could have all the wondrous sights, you could have the most powerful God in your corner, but you won't accomplish anything. If we're going to be the people that goes through the Yam Suf, receives the Torah, goes into Eretz Yisrael, we have to believe in ourselves. We must project that image to the world around us. All right, stop over here.